Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, conflict and political unrest in Africa has forced thousands of people to flee their homelands in the hope of finding better lives. Many Sudanese and their families have sought refuge across the border in Egypt. But the large number of refugees is placing a strain on Egypt's resources. Elhadi Osman is a refugee from Khartoum, the Sudanese capital. He told VOA that he left Sudan for religious reasons. He worked as a writer and reporter until Sudanese police targeted him for becoming a Christian. Elhadi said that police told him to stop going to religious services and reject Christianity, but he refused. "When they jailed me, they beat me and hung me upside down in prison," he added. Elhadi said that he fled to Cairo in 2014 after spending weeks in a Sudanese jail. When he arrived, he spent weeks sleeping on a walkway in a poor neighborhood. Now, he seeks help from refugee agencies to find work in order to survive. Sudanese refugees in Egypt, like Elhadi, keep a watchful eye on events back in Sudan. Many dream of returning home if the current leadership there changes. Santo McCoy is a political refugee from South Sudan. He studied fine arts at Khartoum University in Sudan's north before the South became independent in 2011. He worked for a European non-governmental organization called War Child, where he taught refugee children how to paint. Santo is registered as a refugee with the United Nations, but continues to create art at a studio created by an Egyptian aid group. Noor Khalil is a lawyer and represents immigrants living in Egypt. Khalil says the refugee crisis there is even worse than official reports suggest. Tens of thousands of Syrians, Yemenis, Ethiopians, Eritreans, and Libyans have left their countries because of the many conflicts in the area. Many of these individuals are not officially registered with the UN Refugee Agency, the UNHCR. At a recent gathering of heads of state and government from Europe and Africa, Egypt's president said that his country is heavily burdened by the millions of refugees living there. President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi added that Egypt has prevented boatloads of refugees from leaving its territory for Europe since 2016. The UNHCR says Egypt has given refugees protection, health care, schooling, as well as the right to work. A UNHCR spokesperson told VOA that the United Nations makes sure that they have access to basic services and are also supported and protected in the best way we can. But she added that the current resistance to refugees in many countries is delaying the work of her organization. She noted that only 55,000 refugees out of millions were resettled by UNHCR in other countries last year. For now, the life of a refugee in Egypt has become a struggle. Many refugees choose to go on to Libya and from there try to reach Europe by boat. Many others have also found themselves detained in a Libyan jail under what have been described as inhuman conditions.
Precious is 26 years old and 16 weeks pregnant. She asked VOA to call her by that name to protect her identity. Her best friend is also pregnant by the same man, a man Precious once considered her boyfriend. This information led her to the difficult decision to seek an abortion. Precious lives in South Africa, where such operations are legal. A woman can ask a healthcare worker to perform an abortion during the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. The woman is not required to provide a reason for the operation. After 12 weeks, she must state a reason and a doctor must be present. But when Precious tried to end the pregnancy in her home city of Johannesburg, she had a problem. When I went to register my name, I simply said I want to do an abortion. And they said no, she told VOA. And there were two nurses there, and one said, no, you have to go back to your place and do it there. Then we had a disagreement there, as like, I'm being against God, Precious said. Reproductive health activists say an experience like hers is fairly common. They say that is why 10,000 South African women every year have illegal abortions from unqualified providers. South African health officials estimated that as many as 25% of all maternal deaths are from infectious miscarriages caused by illegal abortions. More than half of all abortions in the country are performed by unregistered providers. Yet all government hospitals offer the operation for free. Precious was fearful that her neighbors would learn she had an abortion, so she chose to travel to the town of Rustenburg, where aid agency Doctors Without Borders operates a medical center that performs abortions for free. Whitney Chinogwenya works at Marie Stopes, one of South Africa's best-known private abortion providers. She says the company recently launched a campaign to reduce the stigma around abortion. When a woman wants to terminate a pregnancy, they're going to terminate the pregnancy, she told VOA from the company's office in Johannesburg. She added that South Africa offers safe, legal, and free abortions, but few women know that abortion is legal. They think they must go to an illegal provider. Medical experts told VOA many stories of poor medical care, including giving patients the wrong medication. Nurse Kagaladi Mfalel is the head of the Doctors Without Borders project in Rustenburg. He says demand for the group's services is high. He estimates he performs as many as 100 first trimester abortions each month. He sees women from as far away as Botswana, where abortion is illegal. I'm Susan Shand.
New research has found that a major Greenland glacier that was once one of the fastest shrinking on Earth is now growing again. Scientists from the American space agency NASA recently reported their findings about the Jakobshavn Glacier, which sits off the island's west coast. NASA said Jakobshavn had been Greenland's fastest flowing and fastest thinning glacier for the past 20 years. During that time, it was the single largest source of mass loss from the Greenland ice sheet. Because of the glacier's size and activity, researchers have used it to help predict world sea level rise. Scientists from NASA and other organizations have been observing Jakobshavn for many years. Researchers involved in the study say that since 2016, the glacier has experienced major thickening. It is also flowing more slowly and moving toward the ocean instead of retreating inland. They say cooling waters in the North Atlantic Ocean have caused the changes in the glacier's activity. The cooler waters reached western Greenland's Disko Bay. NASA says water temperatures in areas around the glacier are currently colder than at any time since the mid-1980s. The research is based on information collected from NASA's Oceans Melting Greenland, or OMG, mission and other observations. Ala Kazandar is a glacier scientist with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. He helped lead the study. "At first, we didn't believe it," Kazandar said. "We had pretty much assumed that Jakobshavn would just keep going on as it had over the last 20 years. The research team has recorded cooling water near Jakobshavn for 3 years in a row. Jason Box is an ice and climate scientist with the Geological Survey of Denmark and Greenland. He was not part of the study. He told the Associated Press the new discovery about Jakobshavn was surprising because it had been moving in the other direction for so long. Box said, "The good news is that it's a reminder that it's not necessarily going that fast. But it is going," he added. A statement by NASA confirmed that, even with Jakobshavn's new growth, it is still adding to global sea level rise. Scientists say this is because the glacier continues to lose more ice to the ocean than it gains from snowfall. The sea level rise is just happening at a slower rate. Researchers involved in the study, as well as other scientists, believe Jakobshavn is experiencing only short-term changes. The main reason they think this is because the cold water affecting the glacier was set in motion by a climate system called the North Atlantic Oscillation. This causes a natural, temporary cooling and warming of different parts of the ocean. The system is similar to El Niño conditions in the Pacific Ocean, El Niño develops when winds off the coast of South America weaken. This enables warm water in the western Pacific to move eastward. The study identified a recent period that resulted in a cooling of the Atlantic in general. In addition, extra cooling happened in 2016 in the waters along Greenland's southwest coast, it said. The cooler waters flowed up the coast and reached Jakobshavn. Josh Willis is a lead investigator with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He said the latest research clearly shows that Jakobshavn is getting a temporary break from a long-held climate pattern. But he warns that a great amount of existing research provides evidence that the world's oceans are increasingly warming. And seeing the oceans have such a huge impact on the glaciers is bad news for Greenland's ice sheet, he said. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the 1890s, the American people were deeply divided over the nation's money system. Should the United States support its currency with gold or with gold and silver? The question became the main issue in the presidential election of 1896. Kay Gallant and Harry Monroe tell the story of that election.
Many Americans wanted a gold standard. They said the United States should support its money only with gold. A gold standard, they said, would keep the value of the dollar high. These people were called gold bugs. Most were businessmen, bankers, and investors. Many other Americans wanted the United States to support its money with both gold and silver. They thought the value of the dollar was too high. A high dollar, they said, drove down prices for agricultural products. A silver standard would lower the value of the dollar. These people were called silverites. Most were farmers, laborers, and owners of small businesses.
The debate over gold and silver was especially important because of an economic depression that began in the United States in 1893. Thousands of banks and businesses closed. Millions of men lost their jobs. Foreign investors withdrew their money from America. Americans who had money were afraid to invest it. Many people believed the Depression would end if the government issued more paper money backed by silver. President Grover Cleveland disagreed, and he opposed any legislation that might threaten the gold standard. He noted that every major nation supported its paper money with gold. The United States would be foolish, he said, not to do the same. It could not stand apart from the world's other money systems.
President Cleveland belonged to the Democratic Party. By 1896, many Democrats had become silverites. They gained control of party organizations in several western and southern states. They called Cleveland a traitor to his party and to the American people. They did not want him to be the party's candidate in that year's election. The Republican Party also was divided over the issue of gold and silver. Some members from silver mining states in the West left the party. Others remained in the party but gave support secretly to silverite Democrats. Republicans had done well in the congressional elections of 1894. They won control of both the Senate and House of Representatives. Party leaders were sure a Republican could be elected president in 1896. The most likely candidate appeared to be Governor William McKinley of Ohio.
McKinley was, in fact, nominated on the first ballot at the Republican convention in St. Louis, Missouri. The Democratic Party held its nominating convention in Chicago, Illinois. The most likely candidate was Congressman Richard Bland of Missouri. A majority of convention delegates, however, were silverites, and they expected to nominate a silverite candidate. Supporters of President Cleveland wanted to test the silverites' strength. They demanded a debate on the gold-silver issue. Several men spoke in support of President Cleveland and the gold standard. Several spoke in support of silver. The last to speak was Congressman William Jennings Bryan of Nebraska. He had led an unsuccessful fight in Congress to keep America using silver.
Bryan spoke emotionally during the convention debate. He said he represented America's farmers, laborers, and small businessmen who wanted a silver standard. Bryan ended his speech with a line that became famous during the campaign. It called to mind the torture and death of Jesus Christ. Bryan said gold supporters could not force their money system on silver supporters. "You shall not," he said, "crucify mankind upon a cross of gold." With those words, William Jennings Bryan won the nomination away from Congressman Bland. He would be the Democrats' presidential candidate. He was just 36 years old.
A number of Democrats refused to accept Bryan as their candidate. They withdrew from the Chicago convention and held one of their own. They called themselves National Democrats. They nominated candidates for president and vice president, but they did not win many votes in the election. America's third party at that time, the People's Party, had a difficult decision to make. Populists, as they were called, agreed with silverite Democrats that the United States should have a silver standard. So some believed the party should unite with the Democrats to support Democratic candidate William Jennings Bryan. If they did not, Republican William McKinley was sure to win the election. Other populists feared that such a union would mean the end of the People's Party. The populists solved the problem at their nominating convention. Like the Democrats, they chose Bryan to be their candidate for president. But they chose a different candidate for vice president. In this way, William Jennings Bryan was able to run for president at the head of two separate political parties.
There was a great difference in the way the two presidential candidates campaigned. William McKinley refused to travel. Instead of going to the voters, he let the voters come to him, and they did. Railroad companies supported McKinley. They ran special trains to his home in Ohio. The trip was free. Each trip was the same. A band met the train and marched with the group to McKinley's home. McKinley came outside to hear a statement of support from the leader of the group. Then he made a short speech and shook hands. The group left, and another one came. On one day of the campaign, McKinley met 30 groups this way. That was more than 80,000 people.
While McKinley stayed at home, William Jennings Bryan traveled. He visited 27 states and spoke to 5 million people. Bryan explained that he had to travel because the Democratic Party did not have enough money to campaign in other ways. Bryan spent $650,000 on his campaign. McKinley spent $3.5 million. Bryan's main campaign idea was that the gold standard would ruin America's economy. McKinley's main campaign idea was that silver money would ruin the economy. For a time, Bryan's campaign seemed to be succeeding. More and more people promised to support him. Then, in the final weeks before Election Day, the situation began to change. The depressed economy showed signs of improving. The price of wheat rose for the first time in several years. Perhaps, people said, it was wrong to blame gold for the Depression. Perhaps, they said, the ideas of William Jennings Bryan were wrong.
On Election Day, it was soon clear who had won. McKinley received 270 electoral votes. Bryan received 176. Bryan congratulated McKinley. Then he told his supporters to begin getting ready for the next presidential election. "If we are right about silver," Bryan said, "we will win 4 years from now."
McKinley's election seemed to give new life to the American economy. Within a month, a business publication reported that buying and selling had increased greatly. It said demand for goods had led to the reopening of factories closed during the Depression. At the same time, new supplies of gold were discovered in Alaska, Australia, and South Africa. The extra gold increased the supply of money in the same way silver would have increased it. Taxes on imported goods rose to almost 60%. Under this protective tariff, American industry grew fast. The Depression ended.
The economic depression of the 1890s forced Americans to worry first about developments at home. But there were a number of international developments then which involved the United States.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.